Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Jennifer Law, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.
Welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell, and I have the privilege of sitting down with Maggie Eastman and her parents, Rick and Mary. Her name might sound familiar to some of our listeners because in 2015, Maggie was featured in a documentary titled Maggie's Story. If you haven't had the chance to watch this short film, you can find it free on Amazon Prime. And trust me, if you want to stop this podcast now and go watch it and then come back, you won't hurt our feelings. In this documentary, we find out that Maggie was diagnosed with stage 4 invasive ductal carcinoma in 2014 after donating her eggs numerous times. After battling cancer and the completion of chemotherapy, Maggie went back to school to obtain a master's degree in relational counseling, and her focus has been working with clients diagnosed with cancer and other illnesses. This June, Maggie will celebrate 5 years of remission. I am super excited to have Maggie and her parents here today to remind us of her personal story and to continue the discussion on the fertility industry, as well as the changes they've seen or experienced since her documentary. Welcome, Maggie, Rick, and Mary. Thank you so much for joining me on Venus Rising.
Thank you.
Okay, so it sounds like 2021 is a very big year for you. Congratulations. For those listeners that have no idea what we're talking about and don't know who you are, can you briefly tell us your story?
Sure. I started meeting my eggs in college. I was taking care of some kids in a sort of nanny role, and their mother had had a really difficult time getting pregnant and had ended up going through in vitro several times. And then she and her husband adopted a couple of kids, and then she got pregnant. And they were hosting a party one evening and asked if I could, watch the kids. And so I was there, and I was approached by a woman that worked at the fertility clinic that they had gone through, and just started off as a conversation and talked to me about, have I ever thought about donating my eggs, and asked me a lot of questions about myself. And that's kind of how it started. And I found myself in the clinic, and I felt like I was really kind of courted, I guess, for the process of donating. You know, they made a big deal about all of my successes and, told me that I was desirable and all of these things. And I looked into it a little bit and did some research. And at that time, again, this was 2002 or 2003. So internet was very different than what it is today. And there just wasn't any information on egg donation. If you were to Google it at that time, all you got was page after page of opportunities to donate. Nothing about any studies that had been done, certainly nothing about any risks. And I thought, I asked all the right questions, and I met with the doctor, and everyone assured me it was, a pretty easy process and that I would just be doing a wonderful thing. And so kind of got caught up in all of that and started donating. And over the course of, from about 2002 until 2013, I donated 10 times. And the majority of those times, actually, I think every time after the initial time, was them contacting me, asking me to. And I got caught up in I didn't feel like I could say no. I felt like I would be letting someone down. So I continued to do it. And in the back of my mind, I always felt like I was helping someone. And I was always being reassured, you're a great donor and you're so desirable and lots of people want you. And, that kind of praise was really nice to hear. And
sure. Especially for, that young, you were in college, right? So young college girl. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the last time I donated was August of 2013. And, shortly after that, I felt a lump in my breast and panicked. Probably any woman would. I was 32 at the time. I went into my primary care physician, and she referred me out. And after months of scans and ultrasounds and such, I ended up having it biopsied and sat in a room with an oncologist while they told me that it was terminal cancer, and they had zero explanation for why someone with no risk factors would have the type of cancer that I had, which was normally only found in postmenopausal women who had had one or more live births, meaning it's a strong hormone cancer. It just does not happen in younger women.
And did your parents at the time know that you were donating your eggs? Was that something you kind of kept to yourself, or, and because there's extensive like medical history, right, that you have mm-hmm. to fill out?
Yeah. So, I told them that it was something that I wanted to do. They knew that, you know, I've been pretty vocal for a long time that I didn't see myself ever having children, didn't want children of my own. And so I think on some level, I kind of thought, well, if I'm not using my eggs, you know, what's the harm in donating and having somebody else use them? And this is one of those stories that, you know, hindsight is, it kind of kicks in, and I have to try to get myself to go back to who I was at the age that I started donating. And I was young, I was in college, I wanted to be very independent. And so I was disappointed when I talked to them and they were discouraging about me doing it. And so I was a little bit, I hesitate to use the word rebellious. I think I was just naive and was more willing to listen to doctors and nurses that were telling me all these wonderful things about myself instead of listening to the people that truly did have my best interest in mind.
So it sounds like your parents were a little bit discouraging as far as mm-hmm. wanting you to be a part of this process. But then when you started the process, did you have to go to them to find out about your family history, cancer risks, any other type of healthcare risks?
Yeah, they do a pretty comprehensive medical background, and they go back several generations, and you list all of your extended family members. If any are deceased, you list what, you know, what they died from, what age they passed away at. Then for anybody that's living, you know, any current health conditions or health issues. And, you know, at the time that I was filling this out, it was probably a 20-page packet. It was really in depth. But at the time that I was filling it out, I was encouraged to get as much information as I could, but I was told it was fine if information was missing, because what they were really concerned about was any type of genetic issue, that if somebody is using donor egg or donor sperm, they're not going to match you. If you have a genetic issue in your biological makeup, they're not going to match you with somebody that has the same or something similar. And so while I'll say the paperwork was very thorough, it seemed like it was kind of okay if you didn't actually answer all of the information. So I knew longevity runs in our family. I've been blessed with, you know, family members that have lived very long, healthy lives, and we don't have any genetic issues in our family. On top of, no one at that time in my family had ever had breast cancer of any kind.
You talk, and you've kind of alluded to this as we've just been talking so briefly here, but in the film, in Maggie's story, it seems that you had a ton of trust in the fertility industry and in the doctors and in the system, whether that was naivety or just actual trust. Can you talk to us about that, and then what has changed since then?
So I was actually first diagnosed with depression in high school, and it was something that I didn't really talk to anybody about. It was something that I struggled with, but was willing to kind of silently struggle with. Part of that meant very low self-esteem. And I think, sorry, this is really hard to talk about.
Of course. Take your time.
I know that having people kind of fawn over me and tell me that I was smart, that I was attractive, that, you know, that I had all these qualities that were desirable, that somebody would really want, made me feel like I was wanted, like I was part of something. And again, I'm 39 now, but I can't stress enough, you know, at that time I was in my very early 20s, and I just lived in a completely different world. I think I had a sheltered upbringing. My life was a dream. There was just nothing in my life that indicated that I could not trust people, or that I wouldn't ever trust a doctor. I mean, I think culturally, the message is that you can trust doctors. Of course, the difference I know now with the fertility industry is it's unregulated and they're making massive amounts of money off of women like me. So at the time, no, I bought into everything that they said. I was searching for something, some sort of meaning in my life. And this gave me that.
I want to ask mom and dad there, Rick and Mary, briefly, what was your hesitation with Maggie donating her eggs? Why were you trying to protect her from this?
Well, we're a religious family, and as you can tell, it's still difficult. And we just felt that when she explained it to us, as supportive as she was being to others, that it was a hard thing to accept for our family. At the time, none of our children were married. There were no grandchildren. This was a new industry. There wasn't a lot of research on it. We were proud that she wanted to do something that would help so many people who were struggling and really wanted children. We found that was very noble, but we just were concerned about all of it in and of itself. The large doses of estrogen, you know, we had heard stories about cancer, of course, and we didn't know, you know, what the future would hold. Would we have people knocking at our door and say, we're related? I mean, the whole thing was just this mountain that we couldn't explore because there wasn't information out there.
And you were able to kind of see from this wise position those things that Maggie wasn't able to really realize.
Well, I think to
a certain... there's a dilemma when you're dealing with a person who's able and has demonstrated that they will make their own decisions. As a parent, you can find yourself in one of two positions. You can either be unconditionally supportive, maybe not necessarily believing what you're saying, but being supportive, or you can be obstinate and try and communicate all of the things that this person isn't thinking about or doesn't know. And when you have a child who is somewhat headstrong and independent, you're going to drive them away. And so I would say that we probably did a little of that delicate dance, but truthfully, it wasn't part of what we believed in, and really didn't necessarily find that altruistic value that Maggie had found in it. So
we raised our children to be good adults, to have a head on their shoulders, and they thought things through, and they, you know, would start family and friends and country and to think on their own. And so here she was thinking on her own, and it didn't meet our values, but she was thinking on her own. And as a parent, what more could you want for a child than to make their own decisions in life, which they had looked into?
You know, I do just want to say, I think that for as much that I thought I knew what I was doing, I think if my parents had any inkling at all that it would have ended the way that it has, they would have said something. They would have been there to really, you know, put a foot down and say, absolutely not. What they did was continually encourage me to think it through. You know, there are going to be things that come up in your life later on that you can't imagine right now. And, you know, again, as a young woman in my 20s, I think a part of me did think, well, you know, what do they know? The world's so different from when they were my age. So, you know, I heard them, but I still thought I knew better, thought that they were overly concerned about something that they probably didn't understand as well as I did.
And to your defense, to your 20-year-old self's defense, you had physicians and nurses and people who we esteem so highly telling you that this was an okay decision, and you weren't, there were small, I mean, I think you say in the film that the risks were like on one page, you know, there were risks, but they were small and maybe, you know, kind of glossed over. So in your defense, you do have these people kind of encouraging you into this decision. So in the film also, you talk about your very first cycle and that you lit up like a Christmas tree on Times Square, meaning that you had a lot of eggs to donate. And that's why you were such a great donor, or part of the reason you were such a great donor. And you were really excited because that meant that you had a lot of eggs to donate to this particular either couple or mom or dad or whoever. You also alluded to the fact that you weren't aware that the recipient of those eggs could turn around and sell them if they didn't want them. So do you know in total how many eggs you donated, and do you know what has happened to those eggs or what happened at the time?
So each time that I donated, produced somewhere between 17 to 40 or so, 40-ish eggs. And the first couple of times that I donated was with one clinic, and then that clinic stopped accepting egg donor, or not accepting, stopped using local egg donors. And so they started referring to this other clinic, and they actually sent all of my information to this other clinic. And then someone from that clinic reached out and contacted me. And so the paperwork was a little bit different. But the first couple of times that I donated, you know, I signed paperwork that said that I was donating to this recipient. Then I think the nurse told me they usually use anywhere from 3 to 6 eggs to fertilize and implant. And, you know, the goal is that just one of them will take. And even then, the odds are not really that great. At least they weren't back then. So I was told that oftentimes for somebody to donate, it's really great if they can get 8 to 10 eggs a donation cycle, which I think is why, I know is why anyway, they were so thrilled that I seemed to be a mega donor of some kind. It just was apparently very fertile and always responded really well to all of the drugs that they were giving me. So I guess there could be anywhere from probably 200 to 400 eggs. And then my understanding was the majority of them, you know, would not take. So I think this is a great place to highlight just how naive I was, because I was under the impression that each time I donated, it was just to whoever had chosen me as a donor. And that once they got what they needed, which was one child, then, you know, that was that. And I don't know that I ever considered where the rest of them went. It wasn't until years down the road that paperwork changed, and all of a sudden I'm looking at paperwork that says that it's now the recipient's decision what to do with those eggs. They can freeze them. They can be given to someone else. They can do pretty much anything with them. They own them.
To bounce back and to kind of go back to your cancer diagnosis. So do you think that your cancer diagnosis is directly related to your egg donation?
I don't think that. I know that without a doubt in my heart or my mind. And continually reinforced by medical personnel that I actually can trust now. Medical history has been submitted through Jennifer to people that that she's worked with to be published in medical journals. I knew in the back of my mind, I knew after I was diagnosed, within a couple of weeks of being diagnosed, I think I reached out to the clinic that I had donated through and they wouldn't give me my medical records. And it was so humiliating, and I was treated so poorly that I ended up calling my sister and asking if she'd go down to the office and try and get them for me, because I couldn't even stomach going in the building the way that they were treating me. It was such a 180 from these, you know, incredibly warm, welcoming people, all these nurses that said these great things about me and always looked forward to me being there and always treated me so well, to I couldn't get anybody to return a phone call. They were very cold to me. They questioned anything I tried to tell them. And ironically, I hadn't even put it together at that point. I just reached out to them thinking, oh my God, there's something in my genetic history that I didn't know about. And now I have an obligation to inform these people so that they can, anybody that used my eggs, they can let them know, you know, something could be wrong. So to be met with such cold-heartedness was disheartening and definitely planted the seed that, wait a second, something's not right here.
So not allowed to know where your own genetic material is going. It doesn't even belong to you anymore. And then also your own medical records that are your own story. That's your own medical history and story. Have you met anyone else that has a similar story to you?
Through Jennifer, I've connected with people. After the documentary, my name was kind of out there. And, you know, Jennifer and I had talked at length about what was the right way to go forward and what were my ultimate goals? What did I want to have happen? And I found a supporter in her that I've never met anybody like her. And so having that encouragement to, hey, it probably would be a good idea to talk about this, to feel like you have a voice, to, you know, be able to tell your story and start to erase some of the shame that built up over time was very empowering. And I'll always be grateful to her for that. She knew what I needed, and she, it's really helped me get to where I'm at now, and to be able to, again, you probably hear me crying. It's still painful to talk about, but the shame isn't there any longer. You know, there were a lot of emotions in the beginning, shame and embarrassment, and it just would have been really easy to keep quiet about it. But having had the opportunity to talk about it, to do the documentary, to do some follow-up pieces in a book, and to help build a community of women that have similar stories. I do occasionally get emails, or, you know, people will reach out to me and say, hey, I saw the documentary and this is what it meant to me. This is how my story is similar. Or, you know, this allowed me to have a conversation with my daughter, my granddaughter, my niece, whoever, that, you know, I could see them doing something like this, thinking same as I did, that they were doing this wonderful thing. And it's opened up the door to have a conversation about it.
So what has happened? What's your life been like since the documentary? Since, you know, you've kind of been through this battle?
I wasn't sure if I was going to talk this or not, but I have actually been contacted by a couple of the nurses that worked at the clinic. Wow. Over the few years. I think all of them have stopped short of saying they knew what was going on, but all of them have apologized. All of them have said they don't work for them any longer, that they saw people with other issues. They knew people with other issues. I just spoke with one a couple of weeks ago who said she had absolutely no idea anything had happened to me, that the information around the office was kept very quiet and she didn't find out for years that something had happened.
Do you think that all fertility clinics are the same? Do you think that there's such thing as like a good clinic that you could donate to?
Oh, no, I don't. I wouldn't say that there's a good clinic that you could donate to, because I don't believe that egg donation should be happening. So in that regard, no clinic would be a good clinic to donate through. And the reason I believe that is because it's not a regulated industry. There hasn't been studies. Donors are not receiving. You can't make decision and say, you know, I was properly informed and I'm giving my consent for this, when there's loads of anecdotal evidence out there about women dying, women developing cancer, women developing horrible health problems and needlessly suffering. And that information isn't being shared with prospective donors. Unless they're willing to be a regulated industry that gives informed consent, which, let's be honest, will never happen, because who would donate knowing all the real risk factors that are out there? No one would do it. It's an industry that's built on anonymity. So no, I don't believe that. I'd stop short of saying all clinics are exactly the same. I don't know that they are. I feel like I've heard enough stories from women now that regardless of where they were in the U.S., they had similar experiences, which leads you to believe, you could draw a pretty good conclusion there, I think, that they obviously are all operating in similar manners. But no, I just don't believe that there was a quote-unquote good clinic or a good way to be an egg donor. It's too harmful to your health.
Since the documentary, Maggie's Story, there has been a rise of these new platforms where people can find out their ancestry, one of them being Ancestry. Have you looked into trying to find out if any of your eggs have resulted in children that you are related to?
Yeah. So at the time that I first made the decision to donate, there was no one in my life, nobody that I was close to that had children. So other than being a nanny and knowing, you know, the family that I worked for had difficulty getting pregnant, I really, truly knew nothing about what it meant to have a child, raise a child, be a parent. It was so far outside of my life experience at that point that I was detached from it. From even just the concept of what it meant to have a child and how a child that's a result of an egg donor might feel, not having had any choice in the process. So I think I was very detached from the process. I knew the intent was that somebody would be having a child. But things like, you know, you couldn't spit into a tube and mail it away and 6 weeks later have a database of, you know, people that you were related to. It didn't exist. And I had no ability to foresee that happening or being so readily available in the future.
And so quickly in the future, right? Like, it's only been, yeah.
How long? I also, again, I think I had just a really like sheltered upbringing, not in a bad way. I just was very, I had a pretty sweet life. So I didn't know anybody that was adopted. I didn't know anybody that was a child of surrogacy. I didn't have any firsthand experience with what kids go through as far as wondering about their identity, wondering about their genetic makeup, wondering about where it is that they came from. And, you know, I always had told the doctors and the nurses, certainly if anybody comes looking for me, keep my information on file and, you know, I'm fine if somebody contacts me. But again, it was really, I'm thinking that's 20 years down the road and it's really detached. But, you know, recently there have been people that have come into my life that I've had the opportunity to build relationships with that, you know, are the product of adoption or are the product of surrogacy. And hearing their stories about, you know, even people that were raised by wonderful parents, hearing their stories about what they've struggled with as far as identity and, you know, searching for some sort of connection their whole lives really was eye-opening to me. And I thought, yeah, maybe it's time to go down that road of starting to explore how I would feel if somebody really did come into my life that was a product of, you know, a pregnancy because of eggs that I had donated. So I did recently submit my DNA both through Ancestry and 23andMe. And they're great websites, great apps. So I've gotten the information back on both of them. And I did 23andMe first, really just fun information about, you know, your health and genetic makeup, cool maps on your ancestry and that sort of thing. And they do kind of connect you with people with accounts that have also submitted their DNA, and they'll say you share this much in common and this is how you're related. And of course, there's loads of first, second, third, fourth, fifth cousins.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's fun. It's fun to look through there and see, you know, last names, you know, where people are now versus kind of where your ancestors started. And then I got the results back from Ancestry. And in the matches section of Ancestry, of course, they were all, again, all the first and second cousins. And there was one at the top of the list that said parent-child. And I just could never have prepared myself for the punch in the gut that I felt seeing that. And I've had, you know, a week or so to kind of think about it and process it. And I think part of the reason it hit me so hard wasn't that, I mean, obviously I knew it was a possibility. I knew that before I ever submitted my DNA. I think in some ways I thought this would be really, this would be great. But, and I just had this conversation with my parents a couple days ago. So I think what I had this visceral reaction to was seeing those words parent child, which were hard for me to identify with because I've never identified as a parent before. And certainly I'm not saying that I am a parent, but genetically I am. And it just, it was difficult to see it written that way.
Mary or Rick, did you guys have any first reactions to finding out? I guess this is really recent, really, really recent. So a lot of emotions and a lot of things to think through, but did you guys have any initial reactions to finding out that you have a grandchild out there?
Well, you know, when Maggie got cancer, Rick and I are of the generation where people, when we were growing up, when adults got cancer, they died. So that was very scary for us. And then the initial 6 months to a year when she was going through this heavy treatment. But we had, I don't know that resigned is the best word, but we had come to grips with that this was a possibility. We had made our peace with it, let's say, because Maggie is our child and she's very important to us and we want to support her. We tried to raise her to be an independent thinker and supportive of others. So if we didn't show her the same support, that wouldn't be very good. So when she initially told us, I was quite excited. Now, I may never meet this person, but Maggie, when she elected to go down this road, she had a wonderful reason for doing it, and that was to help others. And the fact that she now knows that even through all the suffering that we went through, and she particularly went through, that someone else was helped by that. You know, we believe in paying it forward, and so you pay it forward, you don't always know what you do helps other people. And here is someone that's been helped by her generosity. So I was quite excited, and I'm happy for her. And I think it's just kind of getting used to, you know, what all this means now.
That is an incredibly beautiful way to look at that, that Maggie's and your pain and suffering resulted in this beautiful life that now you're excited about. Rick, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm exactly there. Part of the difficulty, of course, is that this whole reality is still pretty abstract. There's not a name, there's not a face, there's not a forecast or a probability of connecting. There's pieces of data that are out in the system that link, and where that might go in the future is really hard to say, and that's probably the place that I'll find myself, is doing some sort of an emotional audit if I'm at a point where I really need to do that. So it isn't quite the same level of experience, obviously, that Maggie's having, because I'm definitely removed from that. But on her behalf, I think we're in a place where we walk this road with her, whatever it's going to look like, and we're committed to continuing to do that.
You know, when you have a child, there's a lot of blessings. And when you get older, apparently you can back, and some of that anxiety you felt when they were growing up has dissipated, and the blessings come through. And you realize just how much by this child you have been blessed with your life. Well, Maggie has made that possible for someone else. And, you know, as much as we're asked to accept different things, I accept that there are people who are of the same gender who decide to get married. I wasn't raised like that, but I accept that. And I accept that because my experience in marriage has had so many blessings. Why would I not want that for someone else? Just like my experience with raising a family has had so many blessings, why would I not give thanks for that happening to someone else?
I would like to ask you a follow-up question on that, and it might be a tough question, and Maggie, I also invite you to answer this as well, but knowing all that you've gone through and being against donating eggs, what would you say to a family that's struggling with fertility, that's struggling to make their family, as someone who's been on the other side of it, what would you say to them?
And I've had this opportunity to have this conversation with multiple friends that have been down this road, that have struggled to have a child. And my heart goes out to anybody that wants to be a parent and struggles to make that happen in a, you know, sort of conventional way, I guess. I think what I would say is there are people out there that would make amazing parents, and any child would be lucky to be raised by them. No one has the right to put someone else's health in danger to make that happen.
And that's also the way I feel. Now, I know it's tough to go through adoption. I've been through different people with this that I've been friends with. But in a sense, that's what you're doing. Eggs is you're adopting someone else's child. The difference here is that you're actually going through the birth process, in my opinion. And I would encourage them to adopt. I know many people who have, over the years, who have adopted, and some of them have had many adoptions. I don't know exactly how to say this, but some people have looked to have a mixed race child to adopt, or a child from another country. And I've been able to see that child grow up and prosper. And, you know, the fact that they were taken out of an orphanage and not expected to have a family and were given this gift, that's beautiful also. Of course, I'm also speaking from the side of this whole issue that I've never had to go through. I've never experienced infertility. I don't know, and I wanted children very badly. I don't know what that would have done to me.
If you could go back to tell yourself, what would you say to young girls who are thinking about donating eggs? What would you want them to know?
I think I've learned over time that, you know, fertility is just as a basic thing in life, a barometer to measure against. It is to ask, if somebody is really encouraging you to do something, in what way does it benefit them? I've come up against this in terms of, as a cancer patient, do I want to participate in treatment studies? Okay, well, you know, what does my gut say? What is it that I want? What are my goals? How might I be impacted by it? How about the people that are important to me? How are they going to be impacted by it? And also that other piece of, if someone is saying this is something you should do, in what way does it benefit them? Are they really there for me and wanting what's best for me? Or does my participation in something put money in their pocket, further their agenda in some way? And certainly, you know, maybe there are times that happens and I'm okay with that. But at least I've asked the question. At least I've gone down that road of really understanding everybody's involvement in something.
Well, I think we are getting close to the end of our time. And I can understand why you wanted Rick and Mary here. They are lovely. And it seems like you are really surrounded with love and really amazing parents. So I thank you for your time, Rick and Mary. Is there anything that you would like to say before we go, or anything else that you'd like to add before we end this episode?
I think for me, just, you know, going back to, again, who I was when I made the decision to first donate, and thinking about what I thought my future would be like and how that hasn't come about, in large part because of what I've been through, and how sometimes it's a daily thing to look for the good and remind myself to focus on the good that's come out of all of this. I still don't know what my future holds. There will forever be unanswered questions about the repercussions of what I chose to do when I thought I was informed about something. It's not like 20 years goes by and suddenly I have all the answers I didn't have at 21. I don't. And I may never have them. And that is something that 21-year-old me just didn't understand. I've spent a lot of time in therapy, a lot, to work through some of the very, very, very difficult things that I will carry with me the rest of my life. And would it have been a lot easier to just have said, gosh, I think I'm going to trust my parents on this one, and this is probably not something I should do? Yeah. Yeah, it would have been. I can't change it now. So I have to figure out how to live with it.
I'm still amazed that since 2000 and when did you donate? 2002, right? Since 2002, we still don't have a tracking system to track donors and their health. We still don't have a way to make this safe. I don't think there is a way to make it safe, if I'm being honest, but since your donation, we're still not tracking women to see what's happening to them. Are they at an increased risk for cancer? Are they at increased risk for other things like infertility of their own? And I guess if we have all of these other advances like Ancestry and 23andMe, then surely this kind of system wouldn't be that hard, and we're still not there.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You look at somebody that, you know, goes on a list for organ donation, and ends up being a match with a stranger, and they get any one of a number of things, heart, liver, lung, whatever, get some sort of a transplant. That is tracked for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. It's a part of their medical records. It's undisputed. And that, granted, we're talking about two different, very different types of biological material here, but it's not all that dissimilar. And so going back to my point about using that question as a barometer for decisions you make in life, how is the person that's asking me to do this benefiting from this? What benefit does a doctor get out of organ transplant? You're saving someone's life. Why do they track that? To be able to document someone's health over time, mitigate risk, and continue to keep that organ functioning in a healthy way. So ask yourself, if egg donation has been around over 20 years and we still aren't tracking donors, why? Because it is in the best interest of the fertility industry not to have that information available. If it's not available, they don't have to disclose it. They can turn a blind eye. They can say, this isn't happening, regardless of thousands of women's anecdotal evidence that they have fallen victim to the same type of thing I have. Regardless of that, if we don't track it, if we don't put it out there, who does that benefit? Not the children that are product of egg donation, not the egg donors. It only benefits the fertility industry.
Okay. Well, thank you again so much to you three for spending time with me and answering some questions. And I know it's painful and hard, but I know that this is going to benefit people and benefit young women and other families. So thank you for continuing to share your story.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.